From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how the 16th Street Community Health Centers are helping Latinos facing substance abuse problems.
Then a report looks at the impact of foreclosure on voter turnout.
So at the height of the crisis here in Milwaukee, about 7,000 families faced foreclosure if we're looking at, say, 2008, 2009, which is really the height of the crisis.
And Rebecca Mackay's latest novel is set in the Midwest at the height of the AIDS epidemic, but one of the messages she hopes comes out of it is that the epidemic has never gone away.
I've been appalled at the number of people who have said things to me like, wow, there must be so many parallels to the modern day. There are 35 million people in the world living with HIV right now. That's not a parallel. It's still happening.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In general, an estimated 80% of people needing treatment for substance abuse in Wisconsin are neither receiving it nor seeking it. Latinos in particular experience a number of barriers to care, from English proficiency to work demands to a lack of insurance and an internalized stigma which causes many to avoid care.
The 16th Street Community Health Centers have AODA, alcohol and other drug addiction programs, and a medication-assistant treatment program that's especially geared toward the population it serves, including those for whom Spanish is their primary language.
Maria Perez is the vice president for behavioral health at 16th Street, and she joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. She explains some of the challenges in reaching out to the community and establishing trust in such a sensitive field.
It's a difficult enough issue for most people to come in the doors and acknowledge that they have a problem. And I've certainly observed that, and I think we had a year number one, a little bit slow to start, but I'm starting to see indications that it's picking up a little bit. I think that's an effort of really getting the word out that this service is actually available. And we have some very good staff. We have a medically assisted treatment program that we coordinate with our medical providers, and I think the word is getting out. So I have other observations, and they have to do with patients really preferring to seek treatment in their own language, because as you know, language barriers is probably one of the main reasons why people don't seek treatment. They prefer it in their own language, their native tongue. Historically, there are long wait lists and other barriers for AODA services. And in other settings, I've noticed too, with people who are uninsured or underinsured, those services are oftentimes, at least you have to come up with a certain amount of money at the very beginning. So for example, a Suboxone program, many places a person has to come up with a certain amount of money for Suboxone or Vivitrol, if you will, and they don't have the resources, so they just drop out without ever starting.
With 16th Street, we've had you in before talking about some of your other programs. Has it been a great strength to already have established trust with patients who perhaps see just as primary care doctors and then find out about AODA programs if perhaps they were on the fence or didn't even know this kind of treatment existed for them?
What a great question, because I really think it gets at the heart of why the 16th Street, I think, has been so successful. So many of our patients that are walking through into behavioral health and AODA are already existing patients in our primary care. So there's what's called confianza in Spanish. It's like an inherent trust because, they are greeted in their own language, they are seen in their own language, and they really have the immediate trust, and it feels very much like a family in the clinic. And I think that those things are attributable to the success, and we want to leverage that as we start to gain momentum as we provide AODA services.
According to stats from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, the majority of Hispanic individuals surveyed, over 90% reported they did not need to get help because they did not feel that they needed treatment. So obviously this is a big barrier for anyone battling substance abuse, is you need to be motivated and accepting of the help. So how do you as a health professional try to reach out to the community to overcome this, particularly in the Hispanic and Latino communities?
I think you're speaking a little bit to a couple of things. One is the stigma in and of itself regarding substance abuse and just all of those negative associations that go along with having an addiction, not to mention that there are so many that deny that it's a problem. And so many people go to work, they hold a job, they're with their families, and they still may have an addiction. So it's sort of like an invisible problem in some ways. But then, of course, we start to see clinically significant problems evolve out of that. I think that specific to Latinos, what we see, I can give examples with working with men who have addictions. The Latino male, sometimes what's called machismo, which is a prevailing masculinity and a belief that to be a man, I must not have a problem. I must not endorse that I have any problems. So sometimes machismo, which is sort of like an internalized sense of being a man, and that can be a barrier. Another barrier worth mentioning as well is there may be legal status could also be a barrier. Fearful of reporting any personal information as you walk through the door to get treatment and fear that that information will be reported and will result in being deported.
Which I imagine puts additional stressors on someone's life outside of whatever addiction they may be struggling with.
That is correct. Absolutely.
There is also poor retention rates in treatment among Hispanic and Latino populations. What do you think attributes to this?
Some things I've already mentioned having to do with some systemic barriers. You know, there are fewer Spanish language options, and I think the 16th Street does try to address that. We, of course, see non-Hispanics. We see many, many patients that don't speak Spanish, so I just don't want to imply that we only see Spanish speakers, but specifically to this population, there are fewer Spanish options for Latinos, especially when there's a language barrier. Long wait lists can also be a barrier. People simply don't want to wait, especially with the advent of more severe addictions, you know, advanced alcoholism or some of the opioid addiction we're seeing in our communities. There's program reluctance to accept undocumented immigrants as well. We work very consciously at the 16th Street to overcome those barriers and ensure that we're not in the practice of reporting demographic data to get anyone into trouble. Yeah.
As the opioid overdose and addiction rates have risen nationally and in Wisconsin, have you seen the same in your clinics?
We've seen, you know, we've been blessed. I can tell you that I can probably count on one hand the number of overdoses that have resulted in death in my history of working with the clinic. It doesn't mean that it's not happening, though. And it's expected to be on the incline as well, which is why we're very, very much invested in trying to get education out to the patients, too, to remove that stigma and those barriers. And we see that we need to work extra hard for our young people, too, those who are teenagers and young adults who have some unique barriers related to being Latino. So, for example, if you're coming to this country and maybe your parents are undocumented or you don't feel like you fit in with the dominant culture, those might further exacerbate other problems like depression, anxiety, and certainly linking that to poverty. All of those correlate with addiction.
Right. And something you're talking along the lines of the term acculturation stress.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the whole process of knowing who you are, your identity, one might have a good sense of that in their family of origin as a Latino or Latina. But then coming to a dominant culture where, you know you're in the minority. I think it's different if you're in an urban setting versus a suburban setting. So I think in some ways, there's a great resilience on Milwaukee South Side, for example, because there are higher numbers of Latinos. And there's sort of like an orgullo, which is pride, a cultural pride in one's own ethnic group that can actually serve as a buffer to addictions and depressions and those kinds of things. Where I think that if you are living in a more suburban setting where it's a dominant white culture, and there are other challenges to feeling like you fit in and maybe you're facing discrimination and other things, I think those stressors then can lead to other mental health problems, including addictions.
Obviously, stigmas don't go away overnight. Do you find that since you treat families altogether, all ages within 16th Street community centers, Are families being more open about discussing these issues, such as addiction and mental health, and therefore kind of opening the door to show it's okay to reach out?
You know, that's a really great question. And I want to say that I do see movement, and I've been doing this for a long time, over 20 years. Working in the field of mental health. And I have seen movement, whereas when I first started in this profession, more hush-hush, let's keep it in the family, let's only go to the priest and talk with the priest about our family problems, or the perception that mental health treatment or substance use treatment is for people who are, you know, either very mentally ill or just lost to addiction. And I have really seen greater receptivity. I have seen a lot of families coming into behavioral health, seeing our substance abuse counselors, and they really are seeking help for their for either themselves or their loved one. It's oftentimes their loved one, a husband or a teenager. So there is receptivity, and we have to work hard at reducing stigma around. It doesn't mean that you're dysfunctional. It doesn't mean that you're messed up. And sometimes sharing how common it is with a family can help to ease those perceptions.
Right. And having a machismo culture or being seen as literally crazy if you're simply seeing a therapist doesn't help. So how do you help establish trust to let people feel comfortable at looking inwards and focusing on themselves?
Right. So what we do know about working with Latino families in mental health and substance use, particularly with non-acculturated families, we know that, you know, psychotherapy and treatment to us in the dominant culture may look very different than someone who isn't accustomed to receiving services in that area. So, for example, someone from a non-acculturated Latino family might expect a provider of mental health services or AODA to be more like an expert or a technician, or giving them really hands-on advice-giving kinds of interventions. I think with non-acculturated families, the concept of looking inward isn't always something they value as something that's therapeutic per se. Yet, there are other Latino families that with established trust, that confianza that I was mentioning earlier, they do start to reflect inward as we help them to acquire new skills, whether they're cognitive skills or cognitive behavioral interventions, motivational interviewing, getting them involved in a dialogue about change, making changes in their lives, behavioral activation. I know I'm using technical therapy terms, but we have found them to be extremely receptive if applied by a provider who has multicultural sensitivity. So a provider who has the knowledge about the culture, the skills, the particular skill set to apply the interventions. But not only that, but have the awareness of one's own biases about the culture that they're working within and knowing who they are in their own inner space with their own cultural identity. So really looking at the whole person through a multicultural lens, I think, is key to having treatment be successful.
You're mentioning all these key factors in developing a successful treatment program. So how do you train those who are giving these services, your therapists?
Oh, boy. That's a favorite part of my job, really. I oversee currently 48 providers and growing. We continue to expand our services, which I'm really excited about. And one of the things that I'm really enjoying, and the providers also enjoy, are any opportunities that we do within the clinic. I have weekly staff meetings, and many times it's about staffing cases, critical cases, and other kinds of cases, talking about interventions and whatnot. But I also use this time to do some professional development. I have a lot of talent within my team. So we promote a lot of professional presentations within our team and on occasion bring outside expertise to help us to enhance our skill set. But we really, really promote multicultural awareness. In fact, when we talk about a case, we oftentimes challenge one another to look through the multicultural lens. So, for example, maybe religion is a factor in the family that's really holding them together as they assist their loved one with an addiction.
With training not just your physical health staff, but now behavioral, all these other programs, as 16th Street continues to grow and serve Milwaukee communities, what are you keeping in mind to move forward and adapt to the needs of the community that are ever changing?
I'm keeping in mind how important it is to take care of our own teams. These are demanding population challenges. So first and foremost, how to really support the team as they work with very difficult cases so that they don't burn out. So provider burnout, I think I really pay close attention to. Secondly, I use the word population, and I really want to be able to increase access, not by just continuing to add staff, but really looking at evidence-based practices that are designed for populations. So really working effectively to help a variety of mental health problems, including addictions, but in a very innovative way, because we don't always have an hour with a patient. Sometimes we have 30 minutes, and sometimes we're called down to a medical team to see someone in an exam room. So it really does call upon us to be nimble in our approaches. So those are the kinds of challenges that we have in front of us, because those things you don't always learn in graduate school.
Right. What would you say to someone who is struggling with addiction who is not quite stepping into your 16th Street doors for these programs?
Well, you know, it's very important, and this would be supported by the research, to really try to align with them on a relational level. You can't really do much of anything unless you have a relationship. So it's very important when someone is not ready to make changes to really work on establishing a connection, a relational connection, non-judgmental, having them have the freedom to talk about their values, who they are, what's important to them, and really reflecting that to them and really making sure that they feel understood by you. And I think that when a person doesn't feel judged or stigmatized or ostracized or told in a judgmental way, you have to change or you're going to lose your family, or you better stop drinking or your liver is shot. Those interventions we know don't work. So it's very important to, when you can't intervene directly, it's really important to establish the relationship, because with those foundational elements, change can then move forward as you start to weigh pros and cons of making decisions about change. And that's where you can engage the patient on a meaningful discussion.
Well, Maria Perez, I want to thank you for all the change and influence you've had on many people with 16th Street Community Health Centers, and thank you for coming in to share your knowledge today.
Oh, it's my privilege. Thank you for having me.
Maria Perez is the Vice President for Behavioral Health at 16th Street Community Health Centers. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. You can find out more about their AODA and Medication Assistant Treatment programs at WUWM.com. And next week, Leg Effect will feature an interview with someone who has been through those programs.
Coming up, we'll look at how the foreclosure crisis impacted voting patterns and what we can learn from it. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. When the U.S. housing bubble burst in 2008, the country was launched into the most severe recession since the Great Depression. For many families, this meant the loss of the family home.
Between 2006 and 2014, around 9 million American families lost homes due to foreclosure. There have been many studies on the ways foreclosure impacts someone's personal and professional life, but a recent study analyzed its impact on someone's political life.
The report, titled Foreclosure's Fallout, looked at how foreclosures impacted voting patterns in 2012, the election during the height of the crisis. Peru Shah and Amber Wachowski are the researchers behind the report. Shah is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, and Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette.
They joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about their research and to look back on how the foreclosure crisis impacted Milwaukeeans.
Pre-crisis, about maybe 2,000 families a year would face foreclosure. So it's not that people did not experience foreclosure. The Great Recession really exacerbated it, and just the scale was just so much larger. So at the height of the crisis here in Milwaukee, about 7,000 families faced foreclosure if we're looking at, say, 2008, 2009, which is really the height of the crisis.
So we know that foreclosure has a huge impact on people personally and then people at a community level. When you started doing this research, what were you setting out to find?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of research out there looking at the impact of foreclosures on social well-being, public health, and more or less the economics of a family. And Amber and I really wanted to focus on the political consequences. How does something like this, a disruption or a feeling of loss, impact how people feel about politics, their political behavior, and what we think of as political efficacy, right? Like, how do they feel about participating? Does it impact that?
So how does foreclosure impact someone's, I don't know if ability is the right word to put here, but how does foreclosure impact whether or not someone is going to vote?
Yeah, so in political science, there's just overwhelming evidence that resources matter. So resource-rich individuals are more likely to vote than resource-poor ones. So if you think about foreclosure, that can be a huge shock to your household finances, right, the costs of foreclosure. But we also know that foreclosure can pay a psychological toll as well, just the stress. So there's research that's looked at the effects of foreclosure on marital discord, on physical health and well-being, depression. And these sorts of things can also be correlates of political participation. So in terms of foreclosure's effect on turnout, it can be direct in terms of people are just consumed by other things going on in their life, which is keeping a house over their head, as well as just the psychological toll, the emotional toll of losing one's home.
You know, something that comes up in your research is that it's not only the toll on the individual, but it can also be a toll on the community. And something you specifically mention is that organizations, political campaigns, they don't tend to go into neighborhoods that have faced a lot of foreclosure. Why is that?
I think one of the things that we wanted to actually look at and I think hypothesize was how does an impact on a whole community, you know, change how outsiders see that community? So there's that feeling internally of our community is in distress that may impact people's kind of perceptions of their own political efficacy, but also thinking then about how do outside organizations that might be interested in getting out the vote look at that community? Are they thinking this is a community that's actually not going to vote, so we're not going to spend resources on that space? And previous research that Amber and I looked at had suggested that get out the vote efforts really are reduced in these kinds of communities because they don't see them as, you know, getting the return on that investment.
Yeah. So a lot of groups will use the registered voter list in order to do their door knocking, to figure out who they are trying to contact. So if you think about a neighborhood that's facing lots of foreclosure, that's adding uncertainty to that. Are the people there actually living? Are they living at that address? Are they going to be able to have like a positive contact? And so there was some anecdotal evidence that organizations were taking that into account when they're determining which neighborhoods to kind of saturate and to focus on. But we're also social citizens. So our propensity to vote is also shaped by our family members, by our coworkers, our friends, as well as our neighbors. So if you imagine a neighborhood that the foreclosure crisis would have been a real shock, where you would have had several families, several households facing foreclosure. Even if you yourself wasn't facing foreclosure, you might be worried about the toll that the foreclosure crisis is going to have on property values. You might be less likely to see a campaign organization, a political group, someone who's trying to get out the vote, come to your community, do that sort of door knocking. You may have fewer contacts with your neighbors, thinking about if your neighbors are kind of consumed by these other events, that you might actually have those sorts of social pressures and social norms might actually be lower in neighborhoods hit hard by the foreclosure crisis.
Something brought up in your research is the impact of empty homes, mm-hmm. Which are increasingly common, of course, in a neighborhood that is facing foreclosure. When we have these kinds of empty homes, how does that impact a community?
I think it it sends a signal, right, about what that community fabric is looking like and how it's changing for many of the people who are left behind in some ways. I think getting to what Amber was talking about, one of the things that we looked at in terms of this particular stressor is this idea of isolation. We have a quote in our paper about the everyday drip, or the drip of everyday life, I should say, right? And this idea that you get used to the routines in your neighborhood, the people you see. And I think one of the things that others who have looked much more qualitatively at foreclosures is this feeling of isolation, that you're not talking to your neighbors, you have fewer neighbors to talk to, and there's this kind of increased level of stress in a community.
Well, and I think that gets to the idea that this is now a group of people who are facing foreclosure, who are not involved in the political process. What do we lose when we lose their voices?
Yeah, following the foreclosure crisis, there was increasing concern among, you know, some policy experts that maybe the government's response wasn't as robust enough or as quick enough, that the foreclosure crisis kind of continued on. Actually, families facing these sorts of burdens really a couple years out from where, you know, the 2007 to 2009 height of the crisis. So in our paper, we show that for Milwaukee County households who were facing foreclosure heading into the 2012 presidential election, they were about 1 to 2 percentage points less likely to turn out to vote. Now, on one hand, you would say, well, that seems like a pretty small effect, 1 to 2 percentage point drop in turnout. But here we're looking at voters who are homeowners, who are already registered voters, right? So who were already the likely ones to kind of turn out to vote in the first place. So even among what we would call high propensity voters, to still see a drop in their turnout is pretty remarkable. And so if you think about the sort of question of whether or not the government's response was strong enough, was robust enough, was fast enough, if elected officials and candidates are not hearing from voters who are most directly affected by it, it kind of decreases that sense of urgency. And so we know that voter turnout in the United States is pretty unequal. Wealthier Americans turn out at higher rates than poorer Americans do. And what's really worrisome to us was that here we see the foreclosure crisis, which we know disproportionately affected some Americans more so than others, further exacerbated political inequality in the United States in the sense that dropping turnout among those that were hit hardest by the foreclosure crisis.
Do you see any solutions for this problem on the horizon, specifically getting people to vote, whether we're talking about a big election like 2012, which is what you looked at, mm-hmm. or even midterm elections?
So in other work that Amber and I have worked on, we've looked at the roles of community organizations as kind of the in-betweens between what we would say government and maybe elected officials and residents and their role in essentially making those connections and reversing some of the isolation, reversing some of the effects of political inequality and lack of voice. And we have found that they can be effective, but it's a pretty daunting task, I would say, given the number of individuals who one of the kind of consequences of political inequality and feeling like you don't have a voice is that that tends to kind of just snowball. So we haven't been able to look at the 2014, 2016 elections, but not voting in one election may lead then to, you know, further lack of political participation moving on. And so I think relying on community organizations alone, I don't think is probably a viable answer.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When we were looking at the 2012 data here in Milwaukee County, we were interested in whether or not this sort of pattern that we found between the experience of foreclosure and a decreased likelihood that you went to the polls that November, whether that was uniform across the county. And we did see, suggestive evidence of an outlier. And that is among Black homeowners in Milwaukee County seem to be somewhat more immune to the depressive effect of foreclosure on turnout. And the reason that the hypothesis, we don't have overwhelming evidence, it is more suggestive evidence here, goes to this role of community organizations. And here in Milwaukee, Common Ground organized, mobilized our residents in Sherman Park. So high rates of home ownership in the face of foreclosure to demand a response from the banks, a response from local government, whether you're dealing with trying to keep people in their homes or if you're dealing with a vacant property, to have that rehabbed and put back onto the market to stabilize the community. So in that case, I think we see some inkling of the role of community organizations. But my goodness, that was a massive effort on the part of Common Ground, the amount of door knocking and mobilizing that they did over a long period of time was tremendous. But it also tends to be the outlier, right? We did not see much of this across the country. And so while I think, you know, Common Ground should be applauded for the work that they've done and groups should kind of look to them as the things that they were able to accomplish, that task is really hard at the same time.
Yeah. Well, Amber, Paru, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Paru Shah is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, and Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about their research on the impact of the foreclosure crisis on voter turnout.
One more break, and then writer Rebecca Mackay talks about capturing the complicated essence of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s Midwest in her latest novel, The Great Believers. That conversation when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Chicago writer Rebecca Mackay's latest book, The Great Believers, is a work of fiction, but its underpinnings are very real and very familiar to people in this part of the country. Much of the book is set in the late 1980s and early 90s in Chicago's gay community. It was a time when AIDS was reaching epidemic levels and thousands were dying, even as politicians ignored it and broader society often spread fear, misinformation, and distrust.
The book is a sweeping portrayal of that time through the eyes of Yale, his partner Charlie, and their friends and colleagues in the gay community. It also jumps forward to contemporary Paris and a mother's search for her estranged daughter. The book is just out in paperback, and its ability to capture the feeling of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s Midwest was what Rebecca Mackay and I talked about at Boswell Book Company last year. Rebecca Mackay, welcome back to Milwaukee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Always.
Is it true that the AIDS crisis was initially a subplot for you in this book?
Yes, which I then became very quickly uncomfortable with. And I really started initially with this idea of a woman who had been an artist's model around World War I in Paris. That was my initial, you know, I was sitting in a cab, I had this idea, this is my book, right? So I thought I want her at the end of her life looking back, basic math that couldn't have been later than the 80s. So I feel like, okay, I have her in the 80s. She's in conversation with some art guy in the 80s about these sketches she has of her from that time. I have an art guy in the 80s. That's an excuse to write about the AIDS crisis, which is something I've been interested in for my whole life, basically, but interested in writing about for a while. I had a story in my story collection about the AIDS crisis. And for me, as I consider a novel, I have about a year-long period, usually, where I'm just working it over mentally. I am not writing anything. And during that time, I feel really embarrassed when anyone asks me about my work. There's this scene, do you guys remember Amadeus in 1984, the Tom Hulce movie? And he's like totally drunk, and he's the mysterious man in black comes to ask him if he's been working on the Requiem he's supposed to be writing, and he's totally drunk, and he's like, yes, I have it all written down. And the guy's like, where is it? And he's like, it's all up here in my noodle. That's what I feel like during that year of like, yes, I'm writing. And if I had to turn to any pages, there are no pages, and I feel nuts. But during that time, I'm reconsidering a lot of things. I'm rearranging a lot of things mentally. And one of the things that happened during that time was a couple things. One was as I started to research, starting to get the lay of the land through research on art world of lost generation Paris, and I'm starting to get the lay of the land on Chicago AIDS generation. And the gravity was starting to shift really rapidly. It's not that, you know, I'm constantly going to be in love with Lost Generation Paris, but it felt like the tenor of the metaphor. It felt like the thing that should be mentioned, you know, out of scene, where AIDS Generation Chicago was just stealing the gravity. So that's one thing. And the other thing was...
I was just going to say, so when you said before you were uncomfortable with AIDS only being a subplot.
That's the thing. So this is the second thing. I was thinking about the number of movies, TV shows, books that I've consumed in which AIDS is a subplot. And some of them are masterpieces. I don't, you know, there's nothing wrong with them individually. But taken collectively, I think most of what mainstream America consumes is AIDS as a whitewashed subplot, where typically someone is diagnosed, it may be not the main character, they die very melodramatically but very cleanly off stage.
Mark Harmon in St. Elsewhere.
Yes, exactly. Very typically the way that their death is realized is someone goes to visit them in the hospital and the hospital bed is empty, right? Which I think if I ever wrote an essay about this, it would be called The Empty Bed. Right? Like, it's we didn't have to see it, we didn't have to deal with it, but isn't it dramatic, isn't it symbolic? And now back to the main story. And I just couldn't bear to do that. And again, individually, and I'm not calling St. Elsewhere a masterpiece, but there are masterpieces of art, right, that do this. It's not any one of them individually. It's the fact that collectively it starts to become a problem. Why is it pushed off to the side? Let's actually focus on it. Let's look at Dead in the Eyes. I just couldn't do it as a subplot.
You said you have wanted to write about, you've been interested in and you've wanted to write about AIDS Generation Chicago or elsewhere for practically your whole life, I'm assuming your whole professional life anyway.
Yeah.
Do you have firsthand memories of that time that underpin the era as you describe it?
Yes, but they are remote. They have to do with what I saw on TV. You know, my parents had one colleague. My parents were in academia. They had one colleague who my mother was close to who died of AIDS. But I don't think I knew about that until I was a little bit older. It was no one I knew. I really believe, it's really interesting. I think I talk to anyone a little bit younger than me, they don't understand at all. I talk to anyone a little bit older than me and they go, yeah, I understand, but why would you, you know, why were you drawn to do this? And I talk to people just about exactly my age, and to be honest, I'm 40, so... I think people get it instantly. People exactly my age, how foundational this understanding was for maybe not everyone, for a lot of us. You know, you watch the news. I mean, because this is, you know, we're all staying up until midnight and watching 2020 because, you know, it's the 80s, whatever. No one cares. You stay home from school sick. You watch Donahue. You pick it up, right? Whatever it was that I saw, and it wasn't coming from my home, it was not coming from school, it was from TV, to be fully honest. As a child, it was coming at me. And I had a child's porous sense of empathy, where I had not been taught to otherize these people, because my parents never talked about that stuff at all. I had not been, I didn't have any pre-existing prejudices, experiences, anything. This was John Stossel or whoever talking to me and me going, oh my God.
You weren't old enough to be jaded.
Not at all. No. I instantly felt for these people. I think identified them as my people, which has been born out in life, and was horrified and got it. And I had a really weird experience as I was researching. I ended up watching on YouTube. I believe it was Donahue. I was joking about that, but there was a Donahue episode. It was a bunch of members of the New York chapter of ACT UP talking on Donahue in, I'm going to guess, 1989 or 1990. I was watching it, and about halfway through went, oh my God, I saw this. I saw this when it was first on. I was 10, I was 11, I was 12, I was somewhere in there. It wasn't when they were talking, it was when someone in the audience, some woman stood up and said, what about this idea of quarantining everyone on an island? And I went, I saw that. And I was upset. And I was in my family room, and I don't remember beyond that, but I saw this. And, you know, these people were going on this show. There was this, you know, this panel of people. They were pleading for their lives. They're trying to speak to people contemporaneously. They're, you know, and, you know, I would love to take a time machine back and tell them, you know, you were also reaching children. You know, that there, maybe we shouldn't have been watching daytime TV. There are better ways to, but like, you know, you were, I'm sure that in their mind they were thinking, I'm speaking to people my age, I'm speaking to politicians, I'm speaking to policymakers right now. And you were also speaking to 10-year-olds who were homesick from school, who listened and who got it.
So it was in the background, at least until sex ed in high school. You're experiencing it kind of, I don't want to say vicariously, because that's not quite the right word, but you're experiencing it secondhand. What was your process like to appreciate the feel of what it was like to experience that era firsthand?
Yeah, so this is very different, right? I really believe strongly, and I'm glad that I knew this from the beginning, because I didn't waste any time, that you can't empathize your way all the way into that point of view. I had the empathy. I have an overactive imagination. That's going for me. I could not have just sat down in a vacuum and correctly empathized, correctly imagined this experience. So here's the thing. As I set out to do my research, I realized very quickly that there is nothing in book or film form about the AIDS crisis in Chicago. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the same is probably true for Milwaukee. When we look at what is recorded, it's New York, San Francisco, it might be LA, it might be Paris and London. Chicago, you know, wasn't it? It's the third biggest city in America. There are pages in coffee table books, you know, out and proud in Chicago, 1812 to 2013, and you have three pages in there. Chicago's not even in the index of a book like How to Survive a Plague by David France and the band Played On, right? And Chicago's the least of the issue. You know, Milwaukee, which, sidebar, you guys know, I've been telling the story everywhere just as an example of why the stories of other cities need to be told. The 1993 Cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee, which went in the news as Kevin killed a couple of hundred people, largely the elderly and those with compromised immunity. What that meant was that basically everyone with HIV within the city of Milwaukee died in about 2 weeks. It was not reported, it was completely swept under the rug, and I sat down with someone at one point from Chicago who had Milwaukee roots, and he's trying to show me photo albums, and one of the things he thinks is a photo album is actually a scrapbook of funeral bulletins. And he opens it up, and they're all flying every direction, something that I actually wrote into my book later, a scene very much like this. And the reason they'd all been stuffed in there, and he'd never organized them, is they were all from Milwaukee within about a month of each other. And, you know, so that story is so different from the story of San Francisco. It's so different from the story of New York. And those aren't the stories that people absorb. They're, you know, people think they know this narrative. They have no idea, and it's absolutely different. And then you have cities like, so I was in Dubuque, Iowa last week. You would not think that that was a place where the AIDS epidemic struck. Here's what you have, a medium-sized city. It's the kind of city you leave if you're young and gay, right? So people did that. They moved home when they were dying. So one of the people who came to my reading was this doctor who was an epidemiologist, who was the guy that people would come to in Dubuque if they had something like this. So he's the guy who's suddenly dealing with 20, 30 cases of AIDS in Dubuque, Iowa, which you would not think, right, would have its own story. Anyway, so I set out to research Chicago. This is not a story that's out there. It's not been published, which kills me. Which meant that what I had to do was primary source research. I was, for my own work, I'm so glad that I was forced into those first person interviews and so grateful for the people who gave me their time. On the broader scale, I'm really freaked out that this stuff is not chronicled in nonfiction, in film or in book form, and that's my soapbox right now. We need to get it written down.
Well, and I was wondering, is there a point at which the history kind of stops? I mean, you said you went back through the Windy City Times through like 1992. Is there a point at which people stopped looking at that era?
Not the Windy City Times. You know, I stopped there because that's when chronologically, you know, so people haven't read the book. There are two major time periods in the book. I have the 80s, and that it's largely 85, 86, but it goes through 92. But then every other chapter is 2015 Paris, where the woman whose brother's memorial service starts the book is trying to track down her estranged daughter. But largely, you know, largely the time frame of the book is 85 to 92. So I'm stopping in 92 in part because I need to limit my knowledge, right? But no, I think someplace like the Windy City Times, absolutely not. They are still absolutely chronicling it, absolutely never stopped, right? But I've been appalled at the number of people who have said things to me like, wow, there must be so many parallels to the modern day, which I understand the sentiment. Yes, absolutely, we can make parallels to, you know, regimes that don't consider you a human, things like that. There are 35 million people in the world living with HIV right now. That's not a parallel. It's still happening, right? AIDS is still the eighth leading cause of death for Americans aged 25 to 34. And I'm getting comments all the time from people going like, yeah, I remember that time. You know, that was really bad, but now it's such a manageable condition. It's almost like just having diabetes or asthma. It's not. I'm disturbed to see that for many of the same reasons that originally a blind eye was turned, it's those people over there, marginalized people, it's them, that's never gonna happen to me, never mind. We finally acknowledged it, we finally addressed it. As a nation, we looked at it, not perfectly, but we looked at it. And again, we're turning a blind eye to it for other reasons very similar to the original ones, which is that now it's largely African Americans who have this, who have HIV. It's largely people in Africa rather than the United States who have HIV. I feel like it's a return to silence and a return to ignorance in a way that I look at these people that I have come to worship, these early people in ACT UP, and you know, some of them are still around. I know them. And I know how horrified they are by that return to ignorance. And I think about some of the ones who gave their lives in this fight and how horrified they would be. And I just, you know, it's troubling.
There's a point at which Nora, Fiona's aunt, great aunt, makes a comparison between the Chicago gay community during the AIDS crisis and her community in Paris in the wake of World War I.
Yeah.
Was that something that came to you in creating this story, or is that a comparison that others have made?
If anyone else has made it, I don't know.
It's such a powerful thought.
Yeah, I mean, it originated in my mind for me. Someone else certainly might have made it, I think for very logical reasons. No, really what happened was I was starting with this idea of the art scene in Paris around World War I, that lost generation art scene. And here's what really happened. As I was reading, and I was thinking about the AIDS generation already, I was reading this wonderful book called Flappers, Six Women of a Dangerous Generation. And I don't know if they have it here, but I highly recommend it. It basically takes six different women. One is Zelda Fitzgerald, one is Tamara Delempica, the artist, one is Isadora Duncan. And just talking about these remarkable women in the 20s, usually, you know, mostly for the 20s. And in one of the sections, and I don't remember which, probably Zelda Fitzgerald's, it quotes F. Scott Fitzgerald as saying, "We were the great believers." And I was so taken aback by that, because this is the generation of which Gertrude Stein said to Hemingway, "You are all a lost generation." And that seemed like an utter contrast to me. I was so interested in that quote and where it came from. So I looked up the quote, and it comes from a really obscure essay by Fitzgerald that was published posthumously in Esquire, and I've used it as the epigraph on the book, and I'll read it to you. It's funny how many people like will have read the whole book and then ask me where the title came from, and I'm like, you skipped the first page, didn't you, dude? Can't do that. Okay, so the quote is...
People are waiting for the big quote on page 118.
Right, exactly, that's it, right. So the quote is, "We were the great believers. I have never cared for any men as much as for these who felt the first springs when I did and saw death ahead and were reprieved and who now walk the long stormy summer." And that to me, as I'm also researching AIDS Generation Chicago, I'm thinking about the survivors, right? I'm thinking about the people who now 30 years later are here. They were handed a death sentence 30 years ago and here they still are. Or they were there with their friends. They lost their entire generation they're the only one left alive with that legacy. And I talked to so many of those people. That idea of the long, stormy summer became completely fascinating to me. And it wasn't until later that I actually put it together and realized I had to include the then modern day in the book. I was really fascinated by the parallels. You look at this generation in Paris. It was, we tend to think of the writers, the American writers who came there after World War I. The visual artists were coming there before World War I. We have people from all over Europe. You have people, actually all over the world, because you have people like Soutine, Modigliani, but you have Fujita coming from Japan. People coming from often, you know, godforsaken shtetls in, you know, remote Russian villages, getting to Paris, sometimes against the will of their family. It's the age of the art academy. They're studying, they're forming chosen family. They're in this metropolis, they're finding happiness. And then World War I rolls through and the influenza of 1918 rolls through like a bulldozer. And it kills almost entirely young men, young, fit, able-bodied men is who it kills. And then you have that same generation regrouping after the war, trying to move on. That's when Stein calls them the lost generation. And the parallels between that and a city like Chicago or a city like Milwaukee in the AIDS generation, the people who had come there from everywhere to find happiness, to find chosen family, and they had found it. And then AIDS rolls through. Not only that time, but the regrouping, the aftermath. That those parallels fascinated me. That was the, you know, the original backbone of the book, and I think it stays there through the end.
Chicago writer Rebecca Mackay is the author of three novels, including The Borrower, The 100-Year House, and her latest, The Great Believers, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. It's just out in paperback.
Our interview was recorded on site at Boswell Book Company last summer. There is much more of our conversation, and you can hear it at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.